complicated this morning. And I don't want to break it up with announcements and say where is what this week. This is also on your newsletter. And God spake all these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of their parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. The Israelites travelled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom. But the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, "Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in this wilderness? There's no bread, there's no water, and we detest this miserable food." Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us." So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, "Make a snake and put it up on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live." So Moses made a bronze snake and put it up on a pole. Then when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake, they lived. I interject here. Jesus knew about that snake. And he said, predicting the way it was going to be with him, "Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, so that anyone who believes may have eternal life in him." But the story gets worse. In the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 29 years. His mother's name was Abijah, daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord, just as his father David had done. He removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, and cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake that Moses had made. For up to that time, the Israelites had been burning incense to it. It was called Nehushtan. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Colin. Good morning. Just want to say before we get to the talk that I excited you already. On behalf of the leadership team, a big thank you to everyone for last Sunday. It was a wonderful send off for Kath and Phil. So for those who are organising, those who are providing food, those who are directing traffic, serving, singing songs, just being there. Thank you all, because I think it was a really special send off that they deserved. And it's been wonderful having them with us, of course. We're going to miss them like crazy, and I think they're going to miss us like crazy. just to say, if you wanted to contribute to, I think I'm right in saying, Martin, this is the last day you can contribute still if you missed a gift. And also, if you missed a memory for the memory book that we gave them, and thank you for putting that together, then there's a couple of spare pages. So if you want to put something through their door, they can stick it in. So if you wanted to do that and missed it, there's still a chance. It might be difficult for me this morning. Ben did say when I walked in, how can I preach on no idols when he's sitting in the front row? But I'll struggle on. I have a lovely, quirky aunt. Just heads popping up above the bottom there on the screen. Auntie Joyce. She makes me laugh every time I speak with her on the phone. And we generally have a Eurovision party every May, and different people come along. And she was the natural one to invite because she's good fun. But she hadn't quite got the idea. She thought she had to dress up like someone from across Europe. So she was there in sort of a COD Croatian outfit. And she spent all evening like that. And then at the end of the evening, all of a sudden, she lifted up her apron. And, Bob's your uncle, there's a picture of Cristiano Ronaldo. She kept it to the end. Now, it's just one expression of her admiration for the footballer, because she woke up on the night of her 70th birthday. She thought she heard some figures or saw some figures on the lawn. Or maybe she was just dreaming. But she woke up in the morning, and there on the lawn was a wheelbarrow with balloons tied to it. And in the wheelbarrow was like a Guy Fawkes Guy type character. And on its face, of course, was a picture of Ronaldo. So if any of her neighbours now borrow the wheelbarrow, they want to borrow Ron. And I had to do some admin for her at her house a couple of months ago. And I went in there and I needed to go upstairs and check out some of her stuff. And I got up the stairs, turned round, and behind me was this. Yes? Yes, it's Ronaldo, a shrine to Ronaldo. So she doesn't really worship him, but she does like him rather a lot. She's given me permission to mention that, so that's fine. So today's session, of course, is on the second commandment. You shall make no idol, no images in the form of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. So obviously we shouldn't try to work out how this commandment affects us now without really looking at what it first meant to those Israelites originally. So let's strip back in our heads, try to get into their heads, and imagine you have no computer for information. You have no police for the rule of law. No NHS for medical aid. No insurance policies in case something goes wrong. No banks to keep the money secure, not really any money per se. No irrigation system for much needed water in the desert. You've got no trained army to protect you. So you don't know the future. You don't know whether or when someone's going to come and attack you with knives or spears. You don't know whether or when there's going to be a famine. How helpless do you feel? And where do you look for backup? Now, different tribes around you have different gods, and there are many gods worshipped in Egypt, so having an idol as a sort of to another god would have felt very normal, a bit more protection, a bit more coverage in the supernatural, an insurance policy. And Hebrew scholar Jeffrey Teagay says that these images were thought to draw the presence of the god being worshipped to that place. So Colin read about Asherah, she's the voluptuous one on the left. And Baal was the male equivalent in the middle. They were fertility gods, and when you depend on things growing, having livestock, the fertility cults would use human sexuality as worship to engender more growth in the things that you have and you need to survive. So they were very much looked at in other nations as insurance policy. And preacher Timothy Peck says, imagine the supernatural world as being like high-voltage electricity. If you touch it, it might kill you. The idol was thought of as being a transformer that gave the worshipper access to the high-voltage electricity without the danger of being electrocuted. So if this was all normal practice for people in those days and not always taken too seriously, why was God so insistent that there should be no idol worship? Well, the reading gives us one answer. I am the Lord your God, a jealous God. For us, jealousy is negative. But the Hebrew word for jealous describes an intense emotion. One Jewish Old Testament scholar translates it, I, the Lord, am an impassioned God. But if we're using the word jealousy, I think there are two sorts of jealousy, the insecure and the committed. The insecure is when someone's terrified of their partner meeting someone of the opposite sex in case they go off together. In their well-publicised defamation trial some months back, Johnny Depp and Amber Heard were both said to be jealous of others that their partner was working with at the time on film sets. And their relationship couldn't cope with that. The insecure jealousy restricts the other and damages relationships. And I don't see God's jealousy being like that. God stayed with Israel constantly despite their regular turning away. He wanted them to thrive. So imagine I took my wife Kathy to an anniversary meal to celebrate another year together. Then she came into a restaurant with another man saying she wanted him to be part of our celebration because he'd been friendly with us that year. I would be entitled to be jealous because someone was actually impinging on our committed relationship after we had publicly vowed to forsake all others. And that's more the jealousy that God had. God was in an exclusive covenant relationship with Israel, which required devotion on both sides. So that's God's concern for Israel. Idols were going to get in the way of that. The second reason for no idol is that no image can start to do justice to God's majesty and wonder. Deuteronomy 4:15-16 says, you saw no form of any kind the day the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the fire. Therefore, watch yourselves very carefully so that you do not become corrupt and make for yourselves an idol, an image of any shape. And that's because nothing can capture the wonder and the majesty of God. And we find in the Old Testament, God only ever speaks. He's never visually represented. That's to avoid any kind of visual distortion or limit of him. 2 Corinthians 4:18 tells us, we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, what is unseen is permanent, is eternal. So we only have to see the images of the scale and the wonder of the universe to know its creator must be something else again. No one in the planet's history has ever been able to see these things that we can see from tech like the James Webb Telescope. We can see dust clouds. We can see like the one in the bottom corner, there's a planet being born. Or sorry, a star being born. This stuff is unimaginable to see for people even a few decades ago. So how much more insulting after that small part of God's creation and glimpse into who he is, how much more insulting would little figures be that are carved out of wood or stone? Especially as they neither existed nor freed Israel from slavery. Now, I nearly put the golden calf reading in, where you know the story. Moses had gone up to get the Ten Commandments. He was there quite a long time, and the Israelites got a bit panicky. So they got Aaron to make him an idol from their gold, and then they announced, these are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. Well, that's what we think it says. And we tend to think, how could they go to forsake the God so quickly after he brought them out of Egypt? But let's just actually pause a moment, because there might be a surprise. And in this situation, Aaron's actions might actually have been more excusable than we think. Firstly, the word gods, these are the gods that brought you out of Egypt, Elohim, can be translated as singular or plural. It's translated here as a plural, these are the gods. But actually, in many translations, including Jewish ones, it's God. This is a God that brought you out of Egypt. There's only one idol and one altar, not too many gods. And Aaron built that altar to the Lord, to Yahweh specifically. So Aaron was actually probably trying to honour God. And that's how most Jewish translations of the passage treat it. And by making an idol in the form of a calf, a young bull, which symbolised power in the ancient world, Aaron may have been trying to compliment God After all, God's power had dramatically led them out of slavery. Now, Colin read the first few verses of the Ten Commandments. It's often hard to tell where the first and second commandment join. In some translations, in the Catholic Bible, I think, as well, they're one thing. So it says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourself an image. And one commentator summarizes them as the first commandment clearly established whom we should exclusively worship. And the second talks about how we should worship, to not make an image. So the incident with the golden calf doesn't violate the first commandment. They were trying to worship God, but it violates the second commandment. They tried to worship the right God in the wrong way. So God wants no idols because he's an exclusive covenant relationship with his people, and worshipping and trusting in idols insults his majesty and his wonder. So that's where we've got to so far. How do we bring that into the 21st century? Well, let's step sideways a minute and look at icons. These are religious works of art, often paintings used in Orthodox and Catholic churches, often using pictures of Mary, Christ, saints and angels. You've got three of the four there. And they're used in devotion. And the idea of them is that they're a soul window. Window being the operative word, as they're an entrance into the presence of God. They're invitations to keep our eyes open when praying. It's prayer just to look attentively at an icon and then let God speak. But the idea is that, like windows, you see through the icon to God, beyond. And I wonder if that's what Aaron was doing, using a visual representation of the bull, in that case, the calf, to worship God. But however good his intentions, Moses threw down the tablets of stone in disgust and shock at what he was doing, because we should not create images of God. So why I mention icons is the idea of them is that they're a devotion to aid in worshipping God. But often they can be, instead of looking through them to God, we can be short-sighted and look at them, and our vision can stop there. So take this one, for example. Is that the statue of a leper? No, it's the foot of St. Peter. It's actually in the Basilica in Rome, where people travel from across the world to touch or kiss the foot. And they've done it so often, they've worn away the toes. But Derek, you may say, we don't bow to idols. We don't use icons. What use is any of this? Well, I'd like to build on that and make an unusual connection that may, and for some of you it may not, and I apologise if not, but for some of you it might resonate. And I wonder whether sometimes we can treat church in the way that people use an icon, looking at it rather than through it, and whether that might stunt our faith. And it might make more sense if I explain some of the stages of faith. And there are various patterns around of the stages of faith that we go to when we believe. And there are great similarities in them. Some of you will know David Bryan, who was a curate here 20-something years ago. Lovely guy. And he did a thesis or whatever on stuff in the Apocrypha that was way above my level of understanding, but he gave me a copy anyway. And in the front, he'd written these words. He'd written, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. So T.S. Eliot quote is very famous. But I thought, that's a bit arty-farty and a bit posy. So I just ignored it, really. But some years later, I was hearing Brian McLaren, and I have said this before once, but I think it's important, speaking about stages of faith. In his talk, he talked about it being spring, summer, autumn, and winter, and then coming back to spring again. He also used it, because he was promoting a book about it, a word for each of those stages. The word for spring was simplicity. So when we come to faith, things are very basic and simple. It's all a new experience. Things are starting to grow. The summer is complexity, when we evolve in our faith, we mature, we develop. And then we get the autumn. The autumn is perplexity, because the longer we stay in our summer, the more we think, well, does that actually make sense? There's a problem here. I can't quite tie these two bits together. And once we get into that mindset, and people around are quite regularly on the internet about their deconstruction process, we've known it here, that perplexity can become winter. We can go through an autumn where the leaves fall off the tree of our faith, and we're just left with the bare bones, the bare trunk and branches. But then we get to think, hang on a minute, I've rationalised my faith so much to get to the bare bones to make sure I've got the bits I can depend upon. Am I missing out on where I started from? What do I actually believe? What is the core? And let me rebuild. And then we come back to our spring and we start again with, and which is why Eliot wrote those words, because we come back to our spring having gone through the year of our faith. And when we get to our spring and our faith is revitalised and fresh again, then it's seeing it for the first time. Now, not everyone goes through all of the stages, but they have to go in order to work. You can't jump through them. The reason I mention that is because in Christchurch, and Simon and Andrew's Journey of Faith group uses this material, and our mentoring scheme uses this material. It uses this format mostly. So the spring, stage one, life-changing awareness of God. That's our simplicity. Stage two and three, discipleship, learning, and the active life of serving, is our summer, the complexity where we mature. But what they make a big point of is there can be a wall at that point. We can sit there for ages, mature, serving, healthy, apparently all is well. But somewhere around there or after there, the wall comes, where the perplexity comes in. And that's where people hit this point. So if you're feeling at this point that you're puzzled about your faith, you're perplexed about some things, things don't make sense, please don't just deconstruct and fall away. Go on this, the Journey of Faith group. Explore this. Talk to someone. Develop an understanding of where that could actually lead you further forward rather than back. That's why I mentioned, because I think it's very important. We don't often mention this, and people can go through that stage, be baffled by it, and fall away. But actually, it's only halfway through. And afterwards comes all sorts of things about basically knowing the love of God and being able to just live more freely a life. And I particularly mention it in context of what I've just been saying about whether we're worshipping church, is that sometimes when we're at this stage here, the serving stage, our identity here in this room can be what we do. We can be seen as the preacher, the leader, the worship leader, the tech guy, the welcome person. And we can sometimes focus so much on this that we don't look through that, as it were, in an icon way, to God beyond. I don't know if this makes sense, but I found myself desperately wanting the nation to come to God. And I know it would be good for the nation collectively and individually. And it would be great for God to have a bigger kingdom. But I notice in my own life, I sometimes am so concerned about that I'm more thinking about strategy than I am about God himself. And I'm letting the strategy be my block rather than looking through to God. So I don't know if that helps to make sense of it. Now, you'll notice in the readings about the brass serpent that something that God gave them as a sign of healing became something they venerated. It's just tucked away. We read a lot about, as Colin said, that Jesus referring to himself as like the serpent. You look up to Jesus and see healing. But it's tucked away that actually for years that the Israelites were venerating this snake and offering incense to it as if it had done something. It had become an idol. So Hezekiah smashed it. I'm not saying we should get rid of church, by the way. I'm not going that far. I'm just saying, has our relationship with church, that identity here in church, become an idol for us that we don't see past? It may not be. I'm just sort of raising it in case that's something that makes sense for you and resonates. So, idols. I could have spent more time on God's love for us, about trust, or what threatens to steal our attention away from God, but these are aspects of this topic we already covered quite a lot. So, I could have said a lot more about stages of faith, but if it resonates with you, have a chat to me or Simon, or Andrew's on Zoom today, but if you want to contact him, and follow that up. But whether or not these things do resonate with you, something that's for all of us is just a reminder of how the Old Testament foreshadows Jesus. So the two reasons we saw earlier for not having idols were firstly that God is impassioned and wants that devoted relationship with us, his covenant people. But Jesus has enabled that through his death and resurrection. What happened to be foreshadowed by that bronze serpent that was raised up and healed those who looked at it. So Jesus has enabled that relationship to be closer than it ever could have been in the Old Testament. And the second reason we had for not worshipping idols was that no image can capture the glory and majesty of God, even when we look at the universe. But Colossians 1:15 says Jesus is the image of the invisible God. We can gaze on Jesus and see God. So he is both an aid to worship and the object of our worship. Hebrews 1:3 reiterates this idea. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. So God has fulfilled the urge for idols in coming to earth as Jesus. So let's renew our focus on our gaze on Jesus, beyond the distractions, beyond even the devotional aids, and let him change us as we follow.